Chapter 18. The Oregon Trail. A Mountain Hunt. The camp was full of the newly cut lodgepoles, some, already prepared, were stacked together, white and glistening, to dry and harden in the sun, others were lying on the ground, and the squaws, the boys, and even some of the warriors, were busily at work peeling off the bark and paring them with their knives to the proper dimensions. Most of the hides obtained at the last camp were dressed and scraped thin enough for use, and many of the squaws were engaged in fitting them together and sewing them with sinews to form the coverings for the lodges. Men were wandering among the bushes that lined the brook along the margin of the camp, cutting sticks of red willow, or shongsasha, the bark of which, mixed with tobacco, they use for smoking. Reynold's squaw was hard at work with her awl and buffalo sinews upon her lodge, while her proprietor, having just finished an enormous breakfast of meat, was smoking a social pipe along with Raymond and myself. He proposed at length that we should go out on a hunt. "Go to the Big Crow's lodge," said he, "and get your rifle. I'll bet the Gray Wyandotte pony against your mare that we start an elk or a black-tailed deer, or likely as not, a bighorn, before we are 2 miles out of camp. I'll take my squaw's old yellow horse. You can't whip her more than 4 miles an hour, but she is as good for the mountains as a mule." I mounted the black mule which Raymond usually rode. She was a very fine and powerful animal, gentle and manageable enough by nature, but of late her temper had been soured by misfortune. About a week before, I had chanced to offend some one of the Indians, who out of revenge went secretly into the meadow and gave her a severe stab in the haunch with his knife. The wound, though partially healed, still galled her extremely, and made her even more perverse and obstinate than the rest of her species. The morning was a glorious one, and I was in better health than I had been at any time for the last 2 months. Though a strong frame and well-compacted sinews had borne me through hitherto, it was long since I had been in a condition to feel the exhilaration of the fresh mountain wind and the gay sunshine that brightened the crags and trees. We left the little valley and ascended a rocky hollow in the mountain. Very soon we were out of sight of the camp, and of every living thing, man, beast, bird, or insect. I had never before, except on foot, passed over such execrable ground, and I desire never to repeat the experiment. The black mule grew indignant, and even the redoubtable yellow horse stumbled every moment, and kept groaning to himself as he cut his feet and legs among the sharp rocks. It was a scene of silence and desolation. Little was visible, except beetling crags and the bare shingly sides of the mountains, relieved by scarcely a trace of vegetation. At length, however, we came upon a forest tract, and had no sooner done so than we heartily wished ourselves back among the rocks again, for we were on a steep descent, among trees so thick that we could see scarcely a rod in any direction. If one is anxious to place himself in a situation where the hazardous and the ludicrous are combined in about equal proportions, let him get upon a vicious mule, with a snaffle bit, and try to drive her through the woods down a slope of 45 degrees. Let him have a long rifle, a buckskin frock with long fringes, and a head of long hair. These latter appendages will be caught every moment and twitched away in small portions by the twigs, which will also whip him smartly across the face, while the large branches above thump him in the head. His mule, if she be a true one, will alternately stop short and dive violently forward, and his positions upon her back will be somewhat diversified and extraordinary. At one time he will clasp her affectionately, to avoid the blow of a bough overhead, at another, He will throw himself back and fling his knee forward against the side of her neck, to keep it from being crushed between the rough bark of a tree and the equally unyielding ribs of the animal herself. Rienel was cursing incessantly during the whole way down. Neither of us had the remotest idea where we were going, and though I have seen rough riding, I shall always retain an evil recollection of that 5 minutes scramble. At last we left our troubles behind us, emerging into the channel of a brook that circled along the foot of the descent, and here, turning joyfully to the left, we rode in luxury and ease over the white pebbles and the rippling water, shaded from the glaring sun by an overarching green transparency. These halcyon moments were of short duration. The friendly brook, turning sharply to one side, went brawling and foaming down the rocky hill into an abyss, which, as far as we could discern, had no bottom, so once more we betook ourselves to the detested woods. When next we came forth from their dancing shadow and sunlight, we found ourselves standing in the broad glare of day, in a high jutting point of the mountain. Before us stretched a long, wide, desert valley, winding away far amid the mountains. No civilized eye but mine had ever looked upon that virgin waste. Rienel was gazing into me. He began to speak at last. "Many a time, when I was with the Indians, I have been hunting for gold all through the Black Hills. There's plenty of it here, you may be certain of that. I have dreamed about it 50 times, and I never dreamed yet but what it came out true. Look over yonder at those black rocks piled up against that other big rock. Don't it look as if there might be something there? It won't do for a white man to be rummaging too much about these mountains. The Indians say they are full of bad spirits, and I believe myself that it's no good luck to be hunting about here after gold. Well, for all that, I would like to have one of these fellows up here, from down below, to go about which is which hazel rod, and I'll guarantee that it would not be long before he would light on a gold mine. Never mind, we'll let the gold alone for today. Look at those trees down below us in the hollow. We'll go down there, and I reckon we'll get a black-tailed deer." But Rienel's predictions were not verified. We passed mountain after mountain, and valley after valley. We explored deep ravines, yet still, to my companion's vexation and evident surprise, no game could be found. So, in the absence of better, we resolved to go out on the plains and look for an antelope. With this view we began to pass down a narrow valley, the bottom of which was covered with the stiff wild sage bushes and marked with deep paths made by the buffalo, who, for some inexplicable reason, are accustomed to penetrate, in their long grave processions, deep among the gorges of these sterile mountains. Rienel's eye was ranging incessantly among the rocks and along the edges of the black precipices, in hopes of discovering the mountain sheep peering down upon us in fancied security from that giddy elevation. Nothing was visible for some time. At length we both detected something in motion near the foot of one of the mountains, and in a moment afterward a black-tailed deer, which has spreading antlers, stood gazing at us from the top of the rock, and then, slowly turning away, disappeared behind it. In an instant Rienel was out of his saddle, and running toward the spot. I, being too weak to follow, sat holding his horse and waiting the result. I lost sight of him, then heard the report of his rifle deadened among the rocks, and finally saw him reappear, with a surly look, that plainly betrayed a ill success. Again we moved forward down the long valley, when soon, after we came full upon what seemed a wide and very shallow ditch, encrusted at the bottom with white clay, dried and cracked in the sun. Under this fair outside, Reynolds, I detected the signs of lurking mischief. He called me to stop, and then alighting, picked up a stone and threw it into the ditch. To my utter amazement, it fell with a dull splash, breaking at once through the thin crust, and spattering round the hole a yellowish creamy fluid, into which it sank and disappeared. A stick, 5 or 6 feet long, lay on the ground, and with this we sounded the insidious abyss close to its edge. It was just possible to touch the bottom. Places like this are numerous among the Rocky Mountains. The buffalo, in his blind and heedless walk, often plunges into them in a whirs. Down he sinks, one snort of terror, one convulsive struggle, and the slime calmly flows about his shaggy head, the languid undulations of its sleek and placid surface alone betraying how the powerful monster writhes in his death throes below. We found, after some trouble, a point where we could pass the abyss, and now the valley began to open upon the plains which spread to the horizon before us. In one of their distant swells we discerned 3 or 4 black specks, which Reynold pronounced to be buffalo. "Come," said he, "we must get one of them. My squaw wants more sinews to finish her lodge with, and I want some glue myself." He immediately put the yellow horse to such a gallop as he was capable of executing, while I set spurs to the mule, who soon far outrun her plebeian rival. When we had galloped a mile or more, a large rabbit, by ill luck, sprang up just under the feet of the mule, who bounded violently aside in full career. Weakened, as I was flung forcibly to the ground, and my rifle falling close to my head, went off with the shock. Its sharp, spiteful report rang for some moments in my ear. Being slightly stunned, I lay for an instant motionless, and Reynold, supposing me to be shot, rode up and began to curse the mule. Soon recovering myself, I arose, picked up the rifle and anxiously examined it. It was badly injured. The stock was cracked, and the main screw broken, so that the lock had to be tied in its place with a string, yet happily it was not rendered totally unserviceable. I wiped it out, reloaded it, and handing it to Reynold, who meanwhile had caught the mule and led her up to me, I mounted again. No sooner had I done so than the brute began to rear and plunge with extreme violence, but being now well prepared for her, and free from encumbrance, I soon reduced her to submission. Then taking the rifle again from Reynold, we galloped forward as before. We were now free of the mountains and riding far out in the broad prairie. The buffalo were still some 2 miles in advance of us. When we came near them, we stopped where a gentle swell of the plain concealed us from their view, and while I held his horse, Reynold ran forward with his rifle, till I lost sight of him beyond the rising ground. A few minutes elapsed, I heard the report of his piece, and saw the buffalo running away at full speed in the right, and immediately after, the hunter himself, unsuccessful as before, came up and mounted his horse in excessive ill humor. He cursed the Black Hills and the buffalo, swore that he was a good hunter, which indeed was true, and that he had never been out before among those mountains without killing 2 or 3 deer at least. We now turned toward the distant encampment. As we rode along, antelope in considerable numbers were flying lightly in all directions over the plain, but not one of them would stand and be shot at. When we reached the foot of the mountain ridge that lay between us and the village, we were too impatient to take the smooth and circuitous route, so turning short to the left, we drove our wearied animals directly upward among the rocks. Still more antelope were leaping about among these flinty hillsides. Each of us shot at one, though from a great distance, and each missed his mark. At length we reached the summit of the last ridge. Looking down, we saw the bustling camp in the valley at our feet, and ingloriously descended to it. As we rode among the lodges, the Indians looked in vain for the fresh meat that should have hung behind our saddles, and the squaws uttered various suppressed ejaculations, to the great indignation of Rienal. Our mortification was increased when we rode up to his lodge. Here we saw his young Indian relative, the Hailstorm, his light graceful figure reclining on the ground in an easy attitude, while with his friend the Rabbit, who sat by his side, he was making an abundant meal from a wooden bowl of wasna, which the squaw had placed between them. Near him lay the fresh skin of a female elk, which he had just killed among the mountains, only a mile or two from the camp. No doubt the boy's heart was elated with triumph, but he betrayed no sign of it. He even seemed totally unconscious of our approach, and his handsome face had all the tranquility of Indian self-control, a self-control which prevents the exhibition of emotion without restraining the emotion itself. It was about 2 months since I had known the Hailstorm, and within that time his character had remarkably developed. When I first saw him, he was just emerging from the habits and feelings of the boy into the ambition of the hunter and warrior. He had lately killed his first deer, and this had excited his aspirations after distinction. Since that time he had been continually in search of game, and no young hunter in the village had been so active or so fortunate as he. It will perhaps be remembered how fearlessly he attacked the buffalo bull, as we were moving toward our camp at the Medicine Bow Mountain. All this success had produced a marked change in his character. As I first remembered him, he always shunned the society of the young squaws, and was extremely bashful and sheepish in their presence, but now, in the confidence of his own reputation, he began to assume the airs and the arts of a man of gallantry. He wore his red blanket dashingly over his left shoulder, painted his cheeks every day with vermilion, and hung pendants of shells in his ears. If I observed aright, he met with very good success in his new pursuits. Still the Hailstorm had much to accomplish before he attained the full standing of a warrior. Gallantly, as he began to bear himself among the women and girls, he still was timid and abashed in the presence of the chiefs and old men, for he had never yet killed a man, or stricken the dead body of an enemy in battle. I have no doubt that the handsome smooth-faced boy burned with a keen desire to flesh his maiden scalping knife, and I would not have encamped alone with him without watching his movements with a distrustful eye. His elder brother, the horse, was of a different character. He was nothing but a lazy dandy. He knew very well how to hunt, but preferred to live by the hunting of others. He had no appetite for distinction, and the Hailstorm, though a few years younger than he, already surpassed him in reputation. He had a dark and ugly face, and he passed a great part of his time in adorning it with vermilion, and contemplating it by means of a little pocket-looking glass which I gave him. As for the rest of the day, he divided it between eating and sleeping, and sitting in the sun on the outside of a lodge. Here he would remain for hour after hour, arrayed in all his finery, with an old dragoon's sword in his hand, and evidently flattering himself that he was the center of attraction to the eyes of the surrounding squaws. Yet he sat looking straight forward with a face of the utmost gravity, as if wrapped in profound meditation, and it was only by the occasional sidelong glances which he shot at his supposed admirers that one could detect the true course of his thoughts. Both he and his brother may represent a class in the Indian community, neither should the Hailstorm's friend, the Rabbit, be passed by without notice. The hailstorm and he were inseparable. They ate, slept, and hunted together, and shared with one another almost all that they possessed. If there be anything that deserves to be called romantic in the Indian character, it is to be sought, for in friendships such as this, which are quite common among many of the prairie tribes, slowly, hour after hour, that weary afternoon dragged away. I lay in Reno's lodge, overcome by the listless torpor that pervaded the whole encampment. The day's work was finished, or, if it were not, the inhabitants had resolved not to finish it at all, and all were dozing quietly within the shelter of the lodges. A profound lethargy, the very spirit of indolence, seemed to have sunk upon the village. Now and then I could hear the low laughter of some girl from within a neighboring lodge, or the small shrill voices of a few restless children, who alone were moving in the deserted area. The spirit of the place infected me. I could not even think consecutively. I was fit only for musing and reverie, when at last, like the rest, I fell asleep. When evening came, and the fires were lighted round the lodges, a select family circle convened in the neighborhood of Reno's domicile. It was composed entirely of Chesco's relatives, a mean and ignoble clan, among whom none but the hailstorm held forth any promise of future distinction. Even his prospects were rendered not a little dubious by the character of the family, less however from any principle of aristocratic distinction than from the want of powerful supporters to assist him in his undertakings, and help to avenge his quarrels. Raymond and I sat down along with them. There were 8 or 10 men gathered around the fire, together with about as many women, old and young, some of whom were tolerably good-looking. As the pie passed round among the men, a lively conversation went forward, more merry than delicate, and at length 2 or 3 of the elder women, for the girls were somewhat diffident and bashful, began to assail Raymond with various pungent witticisms. Some of the men took part, and an old squaw concluded by bestowing on him a ludicrous nickname, at which a general laugh followed at his expense. Raymond grinned and giggled, and made several futile attempts at repartee. Knowing the impolicy and even danger of suffering myself to be placed in a ludicrous light among the Indians, I maintained a rigid, inflexible countenance, and wholly escaped their sallies. In the morning I found, to my great disgust, that the camp was to retain its position for another day. I dreaded its languor and monotony, and to escape it, I set out to explore the surrounding mountains. I was accompanied by a faithful friend, my rifle, the only friend indeed in whose prompt assistance in time of trouble I could implicitly rely. Most of the Indians in the village, it is true, professed goodwill towards the whites, but the experience of others and my own observation had taught me the extreme folly of confidence, and the utter impossibility of foreseeing to what sudden acts the strange and bridled impulses of an Indian may urge him. When among this people danger is never so near, as, when you are unprepared for it, never so remote, as, when you are armed and in the alert to meet it at any moment. Nothing offers so strong a temptation to their ferocious instincts as the appearance of timidity, weakness, or security. Many deep and gloomy gorges, choked with trees and bushes, open from the sides of the hills, which were shaggy with forests, wherever the rocks permitted vegetation to spring. A great number of Indians were stalking along the edges of the woods, and boys were whooping and laughing on the mountain sides, practicing eye and hand, and indulging their destructive propensities by following birds and small animals and killing them with their little bows and arrows. There was one glen, stretching up between steep cliffs far into the bosom of the mountain. I began to ascend along its bottom, pushing my way onward among the rocks, trees, and bushes that obstructed it. A slender thread of water trickled along its center, which, since issuing from the heart of its native rock, could scarcely have been warmed or gladdened by a ray of sunshine. After advancing for some time, I conceived myself to be entirely alone, but coming to a part of the glen in a great measure free of trees and undergrowth, I saw at some distance the black head and red shoulders of an Indian among the bushes above. The reader need not prepare himself for a startling adventure, for I have none to relate. The head and shoulders belonged to Minsila, my best friend in the village. As I had approached noiselessly with my moccasined feet, the old man was quite unconscious of my presence, and turning to a point where I could gain an unobstructed view of him, I saw him seated alone, immovable as a statue, among the rocks and trees. His face was turned upward, and his eyes seemed riveted in a pine tree springing from a cleft in the precipice above. The crest of the pine was swaying to and fro in the wind, and its long limbs waved slowly up and down, as if the tree had life. Looking for a while at the old man, I was satisfied that he was engaged in an act of worship, or prayer, or communion of some kind with a supernatural being. I longed to penetrate his thoughts, but I could do nothing more than conjecture and speculate.
I knew that, though the intellect of an Indian can embrace the idea of an all-wise, all-powerful spirit, the supreme ruler of the universe, yet his mind will not always ascend into communion with a being that seems to him so vast, remote, and incomprehensible, and when danger threatens, when his hopes are broken, when the black wing of sorrow overshadows him, he is prone to turn for relief to some inferior agency, less removed from the ordinary scope of his faculties. He has a guardian spirit, in whom he relies for succor and guidance. To him all nature is instinct with mystic influence. Among those mountains not a wild beast was prowling, a bird singing, or a leaf fluttering, that might not tend to direct his destiny, or give warning of what was in store for him, and he watches the world of nature around him, as the astrologer watches the stars. So closely is he linked with it, that his guardian spirit, no insubstantial creation of the fancy, is usually embodied in the form of some living thing, a bear, a wolf, an eagle, or a serpent, and Minsila, as he gazed intently on the old pine tree, might believe it to enshrine the fancied guide and protector of his life. Whatever was passing in the mind of the old man, it was no part of sense or of delicacy to disturb him. Silently retracing my footsteps, I descended the glen, until I came to a point where I could climb the steep precipices that shut it in, and gain the side of the mountain. Looking up, I saw a tall peak rising among the woods. Something impelled me to climb. I had not felt for many a day such strength and elasticity of limb. An hour and a half of slow and often intermittent labor brought me to the very summit, and emerging from the dark shadows of the rocks and pines, I stepped forth into the light, and walking along the sunny verge of a precipice, seated myself on its extreme point. Looking between the mountain peaks to the westward, the pale blue prairie was stretching to the farthest horizon, like a serene and tranquil ocean. The surrounding mountains were in themselves sufficiently striking and impressive, but this contrast gave redoubled effect to their stern features.